This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Commercial Investing Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we discuss the relentless pursuit of ROI. Yes, that's right, return on investment and return on inflation. We have a changing future with monetary policy and fiscal policy the way it is, and we need to prepare for it as investors by structuring our transactions differently, and we will talk about that on this episode and future episodes, of course. So we will be back with a fantastic interview for you and a guest today in just less than 60 seconds. Stay tuned.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
My pleasure to welcome Matthew Hart to the show. He is the author of Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal, as well as some other books on diamonds and gold. Matthew, welcome. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Good, my pleasure. And you're located in New York today, right?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. Well, gold certainly is a seductive metal. It's just so visually appealing. It's so unique in its yellow color. You really chronicle the mining issues around the world, and I want to talk to you about whether or not we're in a gold rush. And what's the state of the world as far as gold goes nowadays?
Well, when you say, are we in a gold rush? I believe that we're ending what was the greatest gold rush in history, because there was gold exploration everywhere in the world on every continent except Antarctica. Now, when we think of a gold rush, we generally think of the classic gold rush like California. In California, they mined 850 tons of gold in 10 years. Today, we produce 850 tons of gold in 3 or 4 months. And at the time of the California gold rush, that was a stupefying amount of gold, 850 tons. Today, you know, it's a drop in the bucket. Gold is a $20 trillion a year business. But I call it a gold rush because there was, unlike California, it was the sort of classic gold rush that people in the business call an area play. In other words, someone finds gold in a given area, and then everybody else rushes there and digs for gold. Here, it was price-driven. So it was like the price converted all kinds of marginally prospective land in various parts of the world into suddenly hot land, because where gold was worth $800 an ounce in, say, 2008, at the time Lehman Brothers collapsed, gold price shoots up, and in less than 3 years, it's worth $1,900 an ounce. So that makes all kinds of gold targets all over the world. All of a sudden, ground that was not worth exploring before is suddenly very worth exploring. And that's what created this phenomenal gold rush, where they were drilling everywhere. They were going back to old mines that had been closed and reopened.
And the technology is so much better nowadays. You know, when you made the comparison to the amount of gold being mined today within 3 or 4 months versus 10 years during the California gold rush, it made me think of, I couldn't help but go to the oil and natural gas situation in my mind and think of fracking has made so much more of those commodities accessible to us, and I think ultimately will drive down the price. We might, for the first time, really become a major exporter of those products. What's going on with technology in terms of gold mining?
Some of the biggest advances in technology for gold mining have to do with recovery. In the last years of the 20th century, they developed to a very large extent the heap leaching. In heap leaching, very low-grade ore is profitable because it doesn't have to be treated in a plant. They just heap it up and leach out the gold with cyanide, a cyanide solution, leaches out the gold, and then they capture the cyanide and put it in tailings pond. And I know it sounds very horrifying, cyanide, but it degrades in sunlight quite quickly. And I know in Nevada, where they do a huge amount of heap leaching, in fact, you could say that Nevada, the success of the Carlin Trend is to a large extent because of heap leaching, which made a lot of the marginal ore very, very profitable ore. In Nevada, the environmental people in the state there, the land and water people in the state, have told me that it's just not a problem. They don't have an issue with cyanide. They have other environmental issues. Most of it have to do with dewatering, because as the mines go deeper, of course, they have to pump them out. And a lot of that water doesn't get back into the aquifers it's pumped from. It just evaporates. So there's a lot of water loss from the Great Basin. And I think that's the environmental issue. But to me, that's the big one, that heap leaching has made marginal low-grade ore profitable.
And is there anything else on the horizon? I don't know if you asked someone in the oil industry before the advent of the newer technologies if they knew that, because, of course, we're always somewhat surprised about the next technology. But is there anything that's foreseeable, Matthew?
Well, I guess some exploration techniques are better, but I think you might be looking at different locations for finding gold. For example, under the sea, there are companies now that have developed submersible prospecting systems. And the Chinese, in fact, are building a bunch of these small submarines. And again, the Chinese have licensed a very large area, some ridges, I believe, in the Indian Ocean that they're going to explore. But there's a Canadian company called Nautilus outside of, they're located in Toronto. And they had targets somewhere near Papua New Guinea, I believe. They're under their sort of volcanic vents under the sea and very rich in certain minerals. And they had a gold target there that was very, very rich. And in fact, I think they had a mining plan, but they've been unable to reach an agreement, the latest I read, with the local government. But anyway, there's gold under there. And the fact that the Chinese are interested means that if it can be got out, it will be got out, because they are now the world's biggest gold consumers, as well as the world's biggest gold producing country.
Do you have any concern, and I know you made the disclaimer before we started, Matthew, that you're not a gold bug per se, but obviously you're very interested in the topic, having written two books about it. Do you think any of these new exploration or mining technologies will put some downward pressure on the price of gold?
No, I don't, because I don't think that's what would put pressure on the price of gold, because we're always consuming the supply. We're always eating up their reserve. So mines are always becoming potentially less rich with every day they mine. So you have to find new reserves all the time. I think the gold price is driven by human affairs. I mean, yes, I know there are technical analyses of the gold price and very qualified people who measure the amount of gold, you know, gold supply coming into the market, the market's demands and all of that. But I think fundamentally, brush that aside and get down to the core driver of gold's value, because why should it be worth anything at all? It's this feeling that ultimately that it's an absolutely indestructible asset, because we've always thought of it as an asset. Man has always regarded gold as valuable, and I don't see that changing. What started the bull run in the first place, the big bull run in the price, was a general failure of confidence in other asset values, such as mortgages, equities, even currencies. So that when, by the time Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008 and really kicked the afterburners on under the gold price had already been rising for like 5 years. So I could see that happening again if you get into a situation like, well, just look recently what happened when the Dow plunged, because all of a sudden investors were very nervous about the emerging economies, the economies of developing countries that seem to be rather uncertain right now. So what happened? Well, the equities all fell down. Gold went up, it came to $15. So I think gold is a measure of where we are in our feelings about how the world is going. If people are tranquil, then gold tends to steady down a bit.
It's the fear investment, and it's also the lack of faith in currency investment. So no question about that. I agree with you. What do you think has been the effect of ETFs? There are many people out there saying, and I don't know if you have any of these slightly conspiratorial thoughts about it, but that the ETFs, this is kind of a Ponzi scheme because the gold isn't really there, you know, the physical gold.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist about it, but I don't think you have to be a conspiracy theorist to look at the ETF scene out of the corner of your eye.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ETFs bring a lot of volatility to the market simply because they allow so much gold to be traded so quickly. For one thing, they allow people to buy in quickly and allow people to sell very quickly. So if the gold price seems to be just, if the gold price starts to go down, it's easy to sell. It's easy to unload your position. Let's say you have a holding like the spider. Well, then at the end of the day, the ETFs have to rebalance. And by the way, the reported ETF selling brings down the price. And then at the end of the day, the ETFs have to rebalance by actually buying or selling the amount of bullion, selling in the case of sellers, to rebalance their share position. So it matches up with the bullion they have. So then they sell bullion, and that bullion just dumped into the market in one go, because that's what they have to do. So that tends to intensify the swing. It doesn't cause it, but it intensifies price movement. So price movement, I believe anyone in the gold market would agree, price movements are intensified by the ETFs. Now, whether they have the gold or not, does the spider have the gold? They say it's all in allocated accounts, meaning that their gold is held separate from any other gold. And you can go online, of course, and onto their website and navigate through and see what purports to be a picture of their gold. And then you can also look and see the bar numbers of it all. If you believe in a conspiracy, then you think that's all bunk. And have I actually looked at it? No. And has anybody gone in there and drilled the bars to make sure that they're solid gold? No. So, you know, it's, I understand people have misgivings.
Probably rightfully so. Whenever Wall Street gets involved, it creates so many smoke and mirrors in any equation that everything becomes murky and engineered. And it seems like the simple basic laws of economics, like supply and demand, they become very masked by these products, these financial innovations, as they call them. Talk to us a little bit, if you would, Matthew, about what you think makes gold so fascinating and so fickle. You alluded to that before.
Well, fascinating. It's only quite recently, reasonably recently, that we had any idea the antiquity of our fascination with gold. And in 1972, a backhoe operator in the town of Varna on the Black Sea coast of Bulgaria unearthed a Neolithic tomb by accident. Now, he was just a backhoe operator, and he was digging a foundation actually for the little apartment building when, by accident, as I say, he unearthed this tomb, and they sent for the archaeologists. They opened it up, and inside was this treasure of beautiful little gold objects. Any of your listeners can just go online, type in Varna, V-A-R-N-A, necropolis, or Varna gold, and you'll get all kinds of images of what they found. I have a catalog from the little museum that they built there, the Varna Museum. It's got these beautiful little objects. Those objects, they dated them, 6,000 years old. Neolithic men and women were treasuring these gold ornaments and making beautiful little ornaments 6,000 years ago. That's at the dawn of our civilization. That's before writing. It's before Egypt even gets going. The very dawn of our tradition of civilization. People cherished it. So you can go back to this question, why do we value it? Writer after writer has struggled with this, including great economists and thinkers. The best anybody can come up with this, we've just seen always to have. It seems to be hardwired into the human brain. I mean, the Jastrom, the economist at Berkeley who wrote The Golden Constant, a book that studied the relative purchasing power of gold over centuries, said he thought it was a race memory. So somewhere back there, glitters this impression that gold made on our very distant ancestors in probably a brutish world when they just picked it up, this little lump of something that never corroded or rusted, was malleable, they could shape it into anything they wanted. Yeah. So that hasn't gone away.
I wonder if Bitcoin will stand the test of time like that, huh?
Somehow, my feeling, no. I don't have anything against Bitcoin. It's what it is. I don't have the interest in it. It just doesn't have this huge cultural range that gold does.
These companies that are talking about sending probes to asteroids to mine them, this seems like the most far-fetched, incredibly expensive idea ever. But apparently, it's not. A spacecraft that would go and mine metals from heavenly bodies and bring them back to Earth, that just blows my mind. I'm sure you've read about this. I mean, there's one company that's raising money, and I don't know if they're near an IPO stage or not, or if they've already done it, but it's amazing to me. I mean, I can't believe that would actually pencil out.
Well, I have no idea. I've never seen the sort of the math on it, but things, I guess, tend to seem less absurd the further we get on in time. Certainly, if they do manage to figure out some way that they can retrieve this very heavy, well, I guess it wouldn't be heavy in space, would it? It would weigh nothing. But get it back into Earth without it all just sort of blowing up or something. Or there's a lot of gold out there. That we do know. I mean, NASA, in June, released this very interesting thing. In fact, one of my interviewers told me about it. I went up and looked it up online, and NASA had, observing this distant stellar event in which stars had collided or there was some kind of explosive event far, far off in the galaxy, these very, very super heavy metals were created, and including gold. And they could measure this. How exactly, I'm not sure, but they have ways of measuring matter in distant space. And the scientists said that it would be the equivalent of 50 Earth-sized planets of solid gold. So what would that do to the gold price?
Wow, that is amazing. Investors and speculators alike, they really have to consider this, don't they? This may not actually be that far off. There may just be a massive abundance of this. The thing that makes it valuable is its rarity. Maybe gold isn't the thing for the next 20 years. It might be the thing for the next 5 years.
I think the space mining is probably a fairly long way out, but looking at other sources like undersea mining, that's not so far out. But on the other hand, other big deposits will run out. I mean, look at South Africa. South Africa, you know, the Witwaters Rand gold deposits. 40% of all the gold ever produced in the history of the world comes from that single deposit. And they're certainly running down. So these big gargantuan deposits come to an end. I don't know what the predictions are for the life of the Carlin Trend. Certainly those mines are big million-ounce-a-year bruisers down there. But how long can they go? Eventually they'll mine the last ounce of gold.
Well, I don't know if the last ounce of gold or the last barrel of oil will ever be mined, because it'll cost $2 trillion for the last piece.
Well, there you are. It also becomes totally a function of price, doesn't it? I mean, whether we run out of gold or not depends on the price of gold. If gold turns out to be $10,000 an ounce, well, there's an awful lot of ground there that all of a sudden becomes a gold mine.
Yeah, that's for sure. One more issue along those lines, along the supply lines, I'd like to ask you about is, you wrote a book about diamonds. What is the title of that book?
It's called Diamond, The History of a Cold-Blooded Love Affair.
You profiled a new diamond discovery in Antarctica, isn't that correct?
Yeah, in the Arctic, in the Canadian Arctic.
Okay, the Arctic, wrong polar cap. Everybody has long criticized Beers for monopolizing the diamond market and so forth, but one thing that's interesting is I was reading an article a few years ago about how they're making diamonds in the laboratory now, and they're real. I mean, they're not, you know, fake. This is an actual diamond. It's just made in a laboratory. Any thoughts about that?
Well, the main use for industrial diamonds, it's a very big business. In fact, De Beers is involved in it. And they certainly don't control the diamond trade anymore. They used to, but they haven't for quite a while. The industrial diamonds, the biggest maker of industrial diamonds is General Electric. They have a big press in Ohio. I forget exactly the name of the place. I think it's Worthington or a town that sounds like that. Anyway, it's in Ohio. They're generally used for industrial uses, like drill bits and things like that. The actual making of gemstone diamonds, there have always been stories about this, generally about the Russians, how the Russians are making high-quality gem diamonds, manufacturing them. But I was asked to comment on that by an interviewer recently in England. And I just said, well, I guess if they could actually do it, and you couldn't tell the difference, because so far you can tell the difference between them, then it would destroy the value of gem diamonds, because their value is based totally on rarity. But they haven't so far, and it would be very expensive to do. You would be destroying the market you were developing this technology for. So I don't know if anybody could, you know, unless they could figure out a way to do it cheaply. But other than that, it's not complicated. You need sort of a little seed of carbon, and then it's just pressure and heat. And it's a diamond. And you compress into a very short period what nature takes much longer to do.
In your book, we're talking about the gold book now, Gold, the Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. In your book, you have a chapter on the Camp David coup. What is that about?
Well, that's about basically the end of the gold standard in 1971, when the Nixon government came to power and ended the gold standard. It wasn't really a gold standard at the time. It was the remnant. It was the last.
It was a pseudo gold standard.
It was the last version of the gold standard. The United States dollar, at the end of World War II, the United States had 75% of all the monetary gold in the world, roughly. That's generally accepted. So that would be about 20,000 tons. So the other countries after the war, they couldn't be on the gold standard because they didn't have enough gold. The U.S. had all the gold. So other countries tied their currencies to the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar was convertible to gold. Now, what happened?
Isn't that interesting, though? And then we backed out of the deal so we could inflate our way out of our spending problems.
Well, you backed out of the deal because it wasn't working. What happened was the economies of other countries improved after the war, and so Americans started buying Japanese cars, German cars more, foreign electronics, all things like that. But they weren't buying the same kind of amount of American goods. So what happened was American dollars flow out of the country to buy these other goods. U.S. dollars pile up in these foreign countries, but they don't need the foreign dollars to buy U.S. products. So they just take them to the treasury and cash them in for gold. By the time Nixon came to power, this outflow of gold had turned into a gusher. And from 20,000 tons of gold, the United States was down to 8,000 tons of gold. And Nixon put a stop to that, as we know, by simply canceling the whole deal and saying, from now on, the paper is paper. That's all you get.
Paper is paper, but we will still be the bully of the world and retain the world reserve currency status, so we can control the value of that paper and the amount that we want to create out of thin air. That had to be the best deal the U.S. ever got in history. We'll see if we can hang on to it. It's bothering people all over the world quite substantially.
Completely the best deal.
Good. Well, give out your website, if you would.
Yes, it's Matthew Hart. MatthewHart.net.
Matthew Hart.
And that's got buttons for buying my book, and you can read a little about what I've done and my background, and it's got reviews and articles that I've written. It's very comprehensive.
Fantastic. Well, Matthew Hart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it a lot, Jason.
I've never really thought of Jason as subversive, but I just found out that's what Wall Street considers him to be.
Really? Now, how is that possible at all?
Simple. Wall Street believes that real estate investors are dangerous to their schemes because the dirty truth about income property is that it actually works in real life.
I know. I mean, how many people do you know, not including insiders, who created wealth with stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Those options are for people who only want to pretend they're getting ahead.
Stocks and other non-direct traded assets are a losing game for most people. The typical scenario is you make a little, you lose a little, and spin your wheels for decades.
That's because the corporate crooks running the stock and bond investing game will always see to it that they win. This means, unless you're one of them, you will not win.
And unluckily for Wall Street, Jason has a unique ability to make the everyday person understand investing the way it should be. He shows them a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Yep, and that's why Jason offers a one-book set on creating wealth that comes with 20 digital download audios. He shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches you how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And this set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered for only $197.
To get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia Book 1, complete with over 20 hours of audio, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.